Welcome to Present Company, the Netflix podcast that brings you dynamic conversations with exceptional people behind your favorite series, films, documentaries, and specials. I'm your host, Krista Smith. For years, I was Vanity Fair's ambassador to Hollywood, interviewing countless actors as well as creatives and authorities across the spectrum. My passion is talent, any form of it. How do you know you have it? How do you cultivate it? How do you protect it? And also, I want to get to the heart of what drives it. On this podcast, I'll be talking to people in Hollywood and far beyond. Thank you for joining me. We have a true legend joining the show today, Mr. Eddie Murphy. For this conversation, I had the honor of being invited to his house and interviewing him sitting in his screening room. Now, there's no way to sum up this man's extraordinary trailblazing career. Murphy has scaled the heights from his unforgettable time as a cast member on SNL to his stunning, thrilling stand-up, Delirious and Eddie Murphy Raw, who can forget the red leather suit, to his reign at the box office, smashing records and building franchises. Can you say Trading Places, Beverly Hills Cop, Nutty Professor, Shrek? Oh, not to mention his Golden Globe-winning, Oscar-nominated performance in Dreamgirls. This fall, Murphy stars in Dolomite Is My Name, a true story about comedian Rudy Ray Moore, who is commonly referred to as the godfather of rap. The film tells the true story of Rudy Ray Moore's monumental effort to get a film made, featuring his own raunchy alter ego, Dolomite. In this interview, Murphy also talks about his upcoming return to stand-up, his music, and his next film, Coming to America. It's all here, how he views making people laugh as an artist's highest calling, why he would still consider hosting the Oscars, and how he came to dedicate his new film to his late beloved brother, Charlie Murphy. I began by asking him about his legacy and what Chris Rock had to say about him, which I'm going to paraphrase here, but essentially he said, if he hadn't seen Eddie Murphy on SNL, he'd just be a funny UPS driver in Queens.
Is that what he said?
Mm-hmm. He said that you changed the way you did things that no one had ever seen any African-American actor do on screen or on stage.
That's what Chris said? That's mm-hmm. very nice of him. What are you asking me that?
I'm just asking you, just when you think about, do you ever think about it, your career in terms of that, like all the things you did? And I think about it in watching Trading Places that I watched so many times in 48 hours, is you look at those movies and sometimes when we go back, in retrospect, a lot of things are, you know, you're like, oh, we live in such a different time now in terms of some of the profanity and the slurs that were used then. But what made you so incredible in those parts is like you turn the tables. You were in control in a basically an all-white world, especially in 48 hours. And then in Trading Places, it just is still, it's like my Gone with the Wind is still one of my top favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, you know, but you don't set out to be those things. Providence kind of just made those things happen. It was like the movie business was like they see it a certain way, and then every couple of years something will happen, and they'll go, oh, you can make movies like that? Oh, they'll go see that? Like when James Dean first came on the scene, before James Dean, all the movies used to be about grown-ups, and all the themes were about grown-ups and what grown-ups were going through, and James Dean was the first one that, you know, movies about teenagers and teenage angst and all that. He's the one that made the filmmakers. Oh, you can make movies about young people and they'll go see him? And it just opened up this whole thing. Well, with African-Americans, it was like, with the exception of the Black exploitation era when it was this bum rush of stuff, it was like kind of like one at a time, one Black person at a time mm-hmm. was getting on screen. It was always grown-ups. And it was always a certain type of character that you were playing, as sidekick or a buddy or something. And then I show up and I'm casted as a buddy in the sidekick in 48 hours. But I'm kind of like the catalyst. It's like I'm the, on, if you look at it, I'm the buddy, but if you listen to what's happening in the movies, mm-hmm. like, what's our next move, convict? Now where do we go? Now tell me what we gotta do. Now what? Mm-hmm. So like, I'm going, let's go over here and do that. Let's go. So I'm kind of like the first African-American actor to be in movies where I go into the white world and take charge mm-hmm. and be funny in it. You know? So that was, and that opened up, you know, the door for this, you know, everything that followed afterwards from, you know, everything from Morgan and Denzel mm-hmm. and Wesley and, mm-hmm. and whoever mm-hmm. all came after that. That was all just, it opened up all of that.
How did you learn to deal with that pressure of being Mr. Box Office and delivering things and kind of being the Joan of Arc in a way of forging the path for different kinds of movies?
I never felt like I was forging a path. I was just being who I was, and I was, you know, I was reacting to, I was whatever blew my way, you know, I just adapted to it. Forrest Gump, feather that's floating. Mm-hmm. That's who I was. I was that guy. I was that, you know, whichever way the wind blew me, you know, like, that's why I said I didn't set out to do any of those things. It was providence. It was, I didn't set out to do any of that. It was, I got put into a situation and I did what I had to do in the situation and it turned into whatever. So when I was in the middle of it, I didn't feel like I was opening any door or I was being groundbreaking or anything. It's when you get back, you know, years afterwards and you look back on it and be like, wow, you know. Same with stand-up. It's like when I started doing stand-up comedy, there's like 10 black comics in the whole country, you know, and it might be 40 comics in the whole country when I started doing stand-up. And after my success in stand-up, it kind of opened up stand-up stopped being this fringe thing. It became this mainstream, you know, stand-up comics now that can go sell out the Garden that you never even, guys that never had a TV show or never been in a movie and sell a Garden out. And it kind of like that whole thing started after my stand-up stuff. And with movies, it was this big ocean of black talent, you know, that all started after, you know, my stuff. And looking back on it, I see it. But when I was in the middle of it, you know, you just trying to be funny.
And so successful. I mean, those movies are so successful. And I do want to ask about the characters, because you had done that where, you know, no one had seen that before. And I want to know what your inspiration was for being able to play multiple characters in a movie. And what you did with the Nutty Professor, I think, is unprecedented. We've really never seen that. I know in the past people would.
Well, I love Peter Sellers. And Peter Sellers does great characters. And I loved that. Dr. Strangelove, he did multiple characters in that. I'd seen that. It was a movie with Alec Guinness called Kind Hearts and Coronets that I had seen. And Richard Pryor did a movie called Which Way Is Up where he played multiple characters. So I always liked, you know, when I got the opportunity to do something like that, I had ideas like that because there were movies like that that I had seen. You know, interestingly enough, the very first thing that I ever tried to do when I was a kid, about 10 out of 9, I asked my mother to get me a ventriloquist dummy for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And the very first thing I ever tried to do was be a ventriloquist. And it's like, even from the very beginning, I'm trying to do to be more than one person. It's like, I got this voice coming out of here. Yes, I've always, I've gravitated toward that stuff, the multiple character stuff and the makeup stuff. So I always liked makeup movies when I was a kid. I liked the Planet of the Apes and Hunchback of Notre Dame and all that stuff, Notre Dame. And so when I got the opportunity, I had a lot of ideas for that kind of stuff. And then I found when I started doing it, the reason I've done so much of it was because it frees you up. It's like, you know, everybody has their little moves. You know, all actors have their little moves that they do and they hit it a certain way. And the audiences get this used to seeing you do it a certain way and you have your little moves. And after a while, you know, it's like you just have these moves. And when you put the makeup on, you can't do your moves. So you can't do those. You're this old lady or you're this old Jewish guy. are you this, you know, obese professor? So you have to come up with different ways to be funny. And it was fun for me as an actor. Like this Rudy Ray Moore thing was, okay, now you're playing a comedian. So you got your moves that you do. You can't do your Eddie Murphy funny moves or what, your little thing. You can't do any of that stuff. You can't do a funny laugh. Or you have to be funny like Rudy Ray Moore. And that was the challenge as an actor. Like, okay, I got to do his move. This move has to be funny, but you can't be you being. You got to be funny like him being funny.
Tell me about getting this movie to the screen and why you wanted to make sure everyone knew who Rudy Ray Moore was.
I thought his story would make a great movie. And maybe 15, 16 years ago when he was alive, I went to go see him at a place called Stevie's on the Strip in Ventura Boulevard in Studio City. And he wanted to go on tour. I was like, you know, I think your movie, Your Life, would make a great movie. He was like, man, we should go on tour together. And I was like, oh, no, no. I said, I haven't done stand-up. And back then I was 10 years at 15. I said, I don't have an act. Said, you don't need no act, man. We just go out there and do our thing. And to make a movie, he wanted to, just to have a meeting about a movie, he wanted somebody to give him $1 million. That's why it never came together back then. Because I thought it was a great idea for a movie, but I wasn't giving him $1 million just to sit down and write a script. But then, you know, time went on. And back then we approached, because I was like, you get those guys that wrote Ed Wood, you know, because I love that movie, Ed Wood. I was like, get them, because it's a story like that, you know, about how he made these movies. Because his story is really, you know, guerrilla filmmaker, Rudy Ray Moore. He financed his movies himself, you know, and he did everything out of his pocket, and he casted his movie and went and got it distributed and all that. He did all that stuff himself, you know, way back in the 70s, because he couldn't get into when the big black exploitation wave was going on. He was like the underground for that. They were like, that those guys were turning their nose up to Rudy's stuff. So he had to do it, you know, the hard way.
That was a great scene in the movie when you have him go in with the posters and he's like trying to fit in and he still didn't make it.
Yeah, he was too doughy. But yeah, his story is a great inspirational story about the most important ingredient, you know, when being creative is believing in yourself, you know. And his is a story about, like, he's not Richard Pryor. He's not the most brilliant one. He's just believes in himself. Like I say, he's the loser who would not lose. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. He refused to lose.
Well, there's also elements in the film that were very much like the American dream. Like, he was a true entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
Like, I was thinking about that. Like, how, you know, you would look at this from a different lens and you're like, that guy, that's not just hustle. He was entrepreneurial. When he thought about putting that devil sticker on that first album, about, like, he was a marketer, knowing that people are going to want something that someone's telling them they can't have.
Yeah.
And just wrapping it up. I thought that was so interesting about him. And it's just such a shame that I never would have known about him unless you would have made this movie.
Yeah. And those, you know, in the African American community, the older people, you know, 40 and up, they kind of grow up. Those poems, those are Dolomite poems and the Signified Monkey and Way Down in the Jungle Deep. Those were kind of like things that you kind of grew up hearing around the neighborhood, you know, that were like old. Like, you see when he got those jokes from some hobos or some bums in an alley. So that's the black folks have always loved to rhyme, you know. So even before hip hop, they was rhyme. We were rhyming. You know, the first person I heard rhyming was Ali. I think all of this stuff started from Ali. Muhammad Ali was the first person I heard rhyming about how bad and how cool he was. And all, like, Dolomite, what he's saying is just as audacious as Ali's. I'm the greatest of all times, and I'm this and I'm that, and I drown a glass of water, and all the different type of things Ali is saying he could do. Dolomite says that kind of stuff. I think, and the hip-hoppers say all that kind of stuff as well. And I think the root of it all is Ali.
Did you have it in your house playing? Did your mom let you listen to it? Or was that something you guys were doing in the basement?
Yeah, I had. Well, I had all the comedy records. So I had Red Fox and Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby and, you know, Lord Buckley and Derek and Clive, because I was I started doing stand-up when I was 15, so I had an interest in all this. I used to listen to everybody, and I was aware and listened to Rudy Ray Moore.
Where'd your fearlessness come from at 15 to be able to just say, I'm going to go do this?
I never even thought about it. You know, I look back on it now and I trip about how young I was, you know.
And I mean, you have kids that age. Can you imagine your kids just like, that's it, you're going out, you're doing it?
Like, I was working bars when I was 15, 16. I was working bars, you know. And I didn't look at it as being fearless. I just wanted to get up there and be funny. Like, once I heard Richard Pryor, I was kind of like, okay, that's who I am. Because I was always the funny kid, and not just the class clown. I was never the class clown, because I was always kind of cool. So I was like the cool guy in the back that would say some shit, you know, with perfect timing, and I can do impressions of everybody. But from really early on, I was like the funny kid. And when I heard Richard Pryor, it was like, oh, okay, that's who I am. That's what I am. I'm that what that guy is. And that was 75, 76. So when I started getting on stage, it wasn't like I didn't look at it as it just being a brave thing. I just wanted to get up there and be funny like Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm. A lot of youth and energy and just moving forward.
That's why I wasn't that's why there's no fear. You know, when you're young, you don't know. You know, you just go and do it. You take everything for granted. Mm-hmm. You know, on SNL, when I got on SNL, one of the reasons why I got on SNL the first season that the original cast left, and they brought in a bunch of new people the first time they did that, and they hated it. They hated the show, and all the critics hated it, and the people rejected the show, and it was horrible. And they said, the one bright light on the show is that kid Eddie Murphy. And the reason I was a bright light was because I wasn't even caught up in how grim it was, the show. I was just so happy to be on TV, and I was just so happy to be fun. So that came across. I wasn't like, oh no, I'm on this horrible show that everybody hates. You know, I was right in the middle of that, but I was just so happy to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, I was getting laughs. What's harder to be funny when you're scared or angry or, you know, bitter? You could still do it, but it just doesn't come out the same as if you're like, you know, you're just happy to be there and you're feeling joy and you're excited about doing it. This movie, like, I've been sitting on the couch the last couple of years not doing anything. Because I was like, you know, I want to do something when I'm excited about doing it, because you could see on the screen. I know I could see when I just did something to do something, you know, to get a check or something. I could tell the difference between that and the stuff that I was excited about doing. And this was something I was trying to put together years ago. And when it came together and the script that they put together that we developed, it was just... I'm just excited about going to the set every day, and you could see it in the movie.
What was a favorite part about going back into 70s LA?
I never felt like I was going back to, like, I'm not like that up in my head. I know I'm on a movie set and it's all set and all that stuff. I never go all the way back like that. I could tell you the most unpleasant part about doing the 70s is the outfits, how uncomfortable those clothes are. Mm-hmm. And those were the stuff, that's the stuff we was wearing when I was a teenager. I don't remember it being that uncomfortable. Like, you wear some platform shoes now, and you in your 50s, you put on a platform shoe, you'd be like,
well, they're kind of popular now. I've seen, like, Stella McCartney's coming back and those big giant tennis shoes.
You don't see nobody in their 50s, and that's a young man, that's a young person's shoe. You have to be in your, you know, no older than your 30s, or, you know, your 20s preferably, to get away with the platform shoe. If you and you're 50, I'm 50, I just turned 58. If you 58 and you put on, well, I was 57 when I made the movie, and you put on a platform shoe, you would hear your foot from inside the shoe say, fuck this shoe.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I love the costumes were just incredible, and all the bow ties. And what's so interesting about this film, I mean, you've done multiple characters, but in this, you're playing
one character, obviously Rudy, who becomes this stage persona of Dolomite. And it's interesting to see how the discovery of the wig and how just the tweaking of a different bow tie created this completely different alter ego.
Yeah, for Rudy, yeah. He went and made this dude up. And I never heard of anybody that went in the alleyway with a tape recorder with the and tape recorded, you know, the homeless people and drunks and bums and recorded their stuff and shaped that into it. I mean, can you bend down any lower? Can you bend down any lower, Rudy? I don't know anybody that went down that low and came up with something, you know, and served it up that became, you know, this cult thing and became part of the culture. Those poems and Dolomite and the signified monkey and all that, those poems became part of the culture.
What do you hope an audience that maybe didn't know who he was takes away from a movie like this, like the universal appeal of it?
I think it's a really inspirational story about believing in yourself and seeing your dream, you know, going for your dreams. And it, what's really cool about it, it's like usually when the person is going for their dream, have incredible talent, or the, you know, and you got something and you want to, you know, you've got this great talent. Rudy's movies are horrible. And his stand-up is horrible. And it's like all this stuff that's horrible, but his spirit, and he believes in it so much that it's not hard. When you just look at what he's doing, if you looked at it on paper, you'd be like, what the fuck? Because it's him and how much he believes in it, he sells it to you. And it's like I said, we're making a movie about him. It's 40 years after he did those movies. So it's this great story about, if you believe in yourself, that's the most important ingredient. You know, if we're talking about doing anything, if you could see it, you don't have to be the best and you don't have to be a genius. You don't have to be, you know, incredible. You just have to believe in it, no matter what it is. And that's a great universal story.
And his commitment to it, it just is incredible. Like, he just does not stop. And why do you think those movies hit such a chord during that time? What about him that hit, because you could see the mic in it and it was sloppy.
All of that. But the first and foremost, they worked because they're funny, and one of the crudeness and that was part of the appeal of the movie. When we're in the movie theater, we love that we see, you know, the microphone and you see the, you know, he missed that punch. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that's one of the things that made the movie appealing. It was like the rawness of it, you know. And we got into that. That would became part of the joke. Look, you can see the fucking microphone. His movies became like stoner movies. They didn't start out like that. They started out as, you know, just people couldn't believe what they were seeing, you know? And then in the late 70s, early 80s, they became like and the hip hop has started watching them. They became these stoner movies, like people smoke weed. It's one of those, you had certain movies you smoke weed and watch them, and they're funnier because you smoked weed. It became picture of one of those movies, like, you know, like an El Fellini movie, mm-hmm. or El Topo, Alejandro Jodorowsky movie. You know, they became like that. For me, anyway. What's another one? Putney Swope, Robert Downey Sr. It became one of those types of movies. You trip off it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it looked like you guys had a good time making it as well. And that comes across, like I said, the chemistry and the music and just the first time you've ever played a real life character. I mean, you've done a lot of impersonations of real life
characters. Yeah, this is the first time I ever played an actual person. Yeah. And, you know, I had all of this stuff. I didn't have to look up any, because I was a fan, a genuine fan. And I have all of his movies and I have all of his records and I have watched them for years and years. When this came together, I didn't have to look up anything. I didn't have to study his voice. I didn't have to do, I already did an impression of him. I was like, it just all just fell together. Yeah. And I was ready for it. It was mm-hmm. like,
well, I think your age brings the vulnerability to it too, which makes the performance so good.
Oh, what you mean being an old fucker.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me, yeah, that brings a that brings a vulnerability to it. Mm-hmm. It absolutely does.
Are you happy you got off the couch to do it?
Yeah,
I am. I'm so happy to see you back on
screen.
Yeah,
I am. I got off the couch, and I'm happy I got off the couch. And I'm getting ready to go start a Coming to America. Since I got off the couch, it was like, let me do some things that they want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do that. And I haven't been back to SNL in 35 years. I think I'm going to go host Saturday Night Live this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then next year I'm going to tour, do some stand-up.
I have to say.
And then back to the couch.
Back to the couch.
Yeah, after that run.
Well, the Mark Twain speech was amazing. I just watched it on YouTube when your acceptance speech for that. And it felt like, I was like, wait a minute, this could be something he could take. This is like a little bit of a set here. And you had everybody. When you hear that laughing and you hear there, everyone was responding and it was so funny and I'm laughing just watching it on YouTube. How does that feel when you walk off that stage?
That night I was like, oh, well, okay, I could still do that. Because I didn't know what I was going to do. That was like, okay, you got to say something. So like, you know, the night before that, I wrote something, my acceptance speech. And it was like, oh, you know, you could still, nothing has changed except I just don't get up on the stage and do it. But the process of sitting down and putting it together, and it's like, oh, I could still do that. And it had been a while since I had just talked like that and got laughs and was like, whoa, I remember that. Oh, okay, it's cool. That's when I started thinking, maybe I should get on stage and do some stand-up again. But I was like, I don't want to just pop up out there and just come off the couch and just be out there doing stand-up. So I want to have a movie that, you know, something that was really, really funny, you know. And this was, the way this came together was like, oh, man, I could tour off that movie. I could show up out there being funny after that. Because this movie is, you know, it's inspirational and it's, you know, all of those things. But more than anything, it's really, really funny.
Mm-hmm. What still surprises you about Hollywood now you've been in the business for 30 years?
What still surprises mm-hmm. me?
You know, what in your experience, you know, is there something that you miss from the 80s and the 90s? Or is there something now that you're really enjoying that's kind of surprised you about the business of show business?
Well, it's not show business anymore. Show business is like the old days. You know, like I used to say, it's from vaudeville. It's like the vaudeville had just little periods and it turns into show business was you singing and dancing and acting and you got to have some type of, you know, talent or some kind of thing or craft or something of that. And marketing and distributing that stuff is show business. Not just in show business. The last 10 years or so, it's a big paradigm shift in reality and, you know, just in everything. Everything has changed into this other thing. And it's from the internet and all this different stuff. It turned it into, like, what's entertaining now? It's like, now you can have, like, YouTube, you can go on it literally and say, show me old men fighting. What is entertainment has been broadened over the last, you know, 10 years and the world just shifted into a whole other place, you know. And I'm happy to be around and see and still, you know, I come from this world, but I'm in this world, you know. I'm happy to be here.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many of my contemporaries, the people that came on the scene when I came on the scene are all dead. So it's exciting to be here and see the big change and you know.
Be part of it.
Yeah.
What about music and your music? How important is that to you?
Well, that's, you know, that's what I still do that. I never stop.
Mm-hmm.
I never stop. And it's just, that's all the same. This whatever muscle I use to be funny, I have, you know, a muscle I use to do music, and I use them both all the time. I've never stopped doing music. I stopped putting it out, though. because, you know, that weird look when actors put music out and it kind of looks like, what the fuck is this? What is this? It kind of the audience gets weirded out by it. And I didn't want to be, you know.
I remember Keanu Reeves had his band.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of actors are musicians.
I saw
Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp mm-hmm. just the other night with the Hollywood Vampires. I saw them. It sounded cool. But yeah, a lot of people do music, but it weirds audiences out sometimes. So I wasn't doing it to get more famous or to have a hit record or something. I just do it because I did it. And I've gotten, my chops have gotten better so I can play. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was I don't want to say it was a hobby because I was always into it, but I've been doing it for so long. And, you know, I always have a studio wherever my house is and record a lot. That's what I do most. When I'm on the couch, you know, I'm on the couch with a guitar and what I do mostly in my spare time is music, write and record stuff.
And it just lives in its own Eddie Murphy library?
Yeah, I've got like all types of songs and collaborations and stuff with people all different types of stuff from over the years, never released. I've been in a studio with everybody over the years. Everybody.
And you never release it?
All that stuff will come out, you know, one day. Mm-hmm. You know, 100 years from now when I'm gone, they'll find all these tracks and they'll be like, wow, we didn't even know this guy. We had no idea. You know, that's where, because in the movies or when I'm doing comedy, you know, that's a character or a comic persona. You know, when you're doing music, it's kind of like, that's, for me, that's me. That's the things that I write about and all that stuff, it's me. Like, you get insight to me listening to something that I wrote. You get no insight, you know, to me by watching me be funny. Just, oh, he's funny. But you don't know you won't learn who I am from that.
And that's why it stays private.
Yeah, it's intimate, and it's not, sir, I can't serve it up to you. The audience will have to sit through, you know, two or three songs before I start telling jokes.
How do you find the whole political correctness climate for stand-ups? A lot of them have gotten in trouble and end up apologizing and stuff. Does that give you any pause?
No, because back when I was doing stand-up, I don't know if the time was political correct. The word political correctness hadn't come up yet, but I had people picketing and talking shit mm-hmm. and getting. Mm-hmm. I went through all of that shit back then, you know. So that it was always like that. I know you got to pick your shots now. The stuff mm-hmm. that you say. You know.
Do you have nerves at all about the idea of going back on tour?
No, nervous. You know, doing stand. When I think about doing stand up, it's this. This is the perfect analogy. It's like if you go to the pool, and the water cold? And somebody goes, oh, it's freezing. And you go, and then you go, oh, before you jump in, and you go, oh, the water's fucking cold. That's how I feel with stand up. It's like I need it. It's like, oh, that feeling it's going to be freezing when I first get in. But then, you know, that feeling just before you jump in the pool. So that's not nervous or scared. That's just, you know, I know the water's cold.
And you'll get used to it.
Yeah, you get used to it once you
get
in.
Used to it. Do you think they'll ever be able to talk you into doing the Oscars? I know you had like a false start a couple of years ago with everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you think you'd ever host it again?
I've been to the Oscars two or three times since that thing where I almost hosted. And I gave Jerry Lewis, they gave him an honorary Oscar. I presented the Oscar to him. So I've been there, and I don't have any problems with doing the Oscars. It just has to, the timing has to be right, and everything has to be, you know, so where it's a fun experience and not something that traumatizes you. Because it's a pretty thankless thing, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like you got to do it and just just be happy that you're doing it because it's a big, it's an honorable thing. You know, it's a high honor to be able to host that. And, mm-hmm. you know, but it's kind of like, you know, no matter how good you do, people talk shit about it and you don't get paid no money to do it. It's kind of, you know, it's like, so you gotta just want to do it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. I hope you do. I hope maybe 2021.
We'll see.
You know,
one day,
right? So you dedicate this movie to your brother. And I know family's always been so important to you. And even in the early stand-up, the stories of your family or your family adjacent and grandmother and all of that stuff. What do you want people to know about your brother that never got to meet him?
Well, I don't know if that's why we did the dedication. So we're trying to get people to learn something. That's more for the people that knew about him, mm-hmm. him. And, you know, and he's the first person that told me about Rudy Ray Moore. And he was a comedian. And this is the first thing I've done in so long that was funny. And, you know, I loved my brother and missed him. So that's why mm-hmm. I put, you know, we dedicated it to him. You know, he's connect his name to something that's, you know, that I know is going to be making people laugh. Mm-hmm. And he made so many people laugh when he was here.
Mm-hmm. You know. Do you think you have another generation of actors coming up in your family?
Yeah. My daughter, Bella, she's going to play one of the, and Coming to America, with one of the princesses is, my daughter's going to play one of the princesses. And my oldest daughter, Bria, she's an actress.
Oh, she is?
Yeah. And my son, Miles, Miles Christian and Eric all write and act. So, yeah, eventually you'll be seeing them. But I don't know if they're funny like me. They're all, like, handsome and, you know, and cool and all that stuff.
You do have a gorgeous family.
Yeah,
I can tell. Look
like
at those
beautiful
pictures.
They're beautiful.
It's not fair.
They're not. I mean, they're funny, but I don't know if they're thinking about being funny. They're just funny, like family funny stuff.
Mm-hmm. They make you laugh?
Oh, yeah. The kids are nonstop. You have kids?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarity.
Mm-hmm. You sentimental?
Yeah, I guess I can be sentimental, but I don't pine for or miss the past. So I have a little small circle of friends that, you know, been friends for, you know, 40 years. I have a couple of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a really small social circle.
Do you look forward to things? Are you looking forward to going on SNL? Or are you looking forward to...
Honestly, I don't like to do anything as much as I like to sit on the couch. Yeah.
Everything. What are you watching when you're on the couch?
I'm watching, and sometimes I'm playing with my kids, or I'm watching TV, or I'm playing just sitting there with me and Paige.
Do you get dressed every morning to sit on the couch? Do you have like a routine that you do?
No, I have a routine to sit on the couch. Yeah, but for me, the best time is when there's nothing scheduled and there's nothing to do and I have nothing planned and I don't have to be anywhere and my kids are around. I can hear them in the distance or see them. Everybody's around and it's kind of no schedule and that's the best for me. That's just, so that's what I look forward to. If you get some rest, you know, when you come back to work, or when it's time to go do what you do it better, you know. So I'm all, my battery's—
Are you rested?
Oh, yeah, my battery's charged and inspired. This thing, like, this Rudy Ray Moore movie kind of lit a spark under me because, you know, you're sitting there with an audience and you see the audience laughing and it's like, yeah, that's what I do. And yeah, okay, yeah, it's funny you want to do that. I want to do something else to make it. I got them laughing. I want to do something else while I got them laughing. I do something else, you know. And Saturday Night Live, like I said, I hadn't been back there since, you know, 35 years ago. And I want to tour next year. So I kind of like, this is the, perfect. Even the Coming to America movie, this is like, mm-hmm. I'm kind of bookending. Like, I didn't want if I never make another movie again, I didn't want the last movie I did to be something that wasn't funny. The last movie I did was about a guy that takes care of this woman who's dying of cancer, like a mm-hmm. serious. Mr. Church. It was like a serious
good character,
movie.
Yeah,
and I didn't want to leave it. I love the movie, but I didn't want to leave it there because I'm the fuck you man. I'm the funny guy. So I wanted to do something really, really funny. You know.
You have such power, though, even when you're not funny, even when you're silent, you have a lot of power on screen.
Yeah, but people come to see me to laugh, though. They're not coming for me to be silent. You know, he's sure is powerful up there not talking, but I wish he'd say something funny. Look how powerful he is making those eggs. He could just make eggs and hold your attention. But I sure wish this motherfucker say something funny. God damn.
No one's funnier than Eddie Murphy, but Eddie Murphy should be allowed to make eggs in silence too if he wants to.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. But you know, the people that are checking for me, and I'm not mad at it. They're checking for me because I've made them laugh. And so, you know, they want to laugh, so I want to serve something up funny. I don't think there's any higher calling for an artist. There's nothing that can be compared to being, you make people laugh. To make people laugh, I know I'll take laughter over any type of entertainment. Over, you want to go see a tearjerker, or you want to dance at a party, whatever. You want to see some romance, or you want to laugh. You would rather laugh over anything, you know. And to have that, that's like a precious gift, you know.
I have thoroughly enjoyed hanging out with you and talking to you.
Cool.
I've always been a big fan, so I can't wait for everybody to see Dolomite.
So we got all the important stuff. I'm the funniest man in the world. Mm-hmm. I started it all. Mm-hmm. I opened the doors for everybody. Mm-hmm. And don't start no shit. Mm-hmm. That's basically everything.
Mm-hmm. Dolomite Is My Name will be in theaters and on Netflix this fall. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you've been listening. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. Present Company is produced by Netflix and Gimlet Creative. Join me next time for more meaningful conversations here at Present Company.